Shrink Wrap Radio number 690, geneticist Dr. Sarah Winokur on the pandemic.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is Dr. Sarah Winokur, a geneticist, researcher, and author. Sarah has a master's degree in cytogenetics and a PhD in molecular genetics. Her research helped identify mutations underlying muscular dystrophy, Huntington's disease, dwarfism, and a rare craniofacial syndrome. She continues to work as a consultant on potential therapies for genetic diseases. Given her scientific credentials, we'll be discussing her perspective on the current COVID-19 epidemic. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Sarah Winokur, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you, David. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, I would say it's a pleasure to have you, except the circumstances are so poor for, it's so sad that we have to talk about this pandemic. And, but on the other hand, I'm so happy to have someone with your scientific background and expertise. We've been hearing.
And also the technology that we have, that we are still able to communicate with one another.
Yeah.
You know, if this were 20 years ago.
Oh, I know.
Probably feel that much more isolated.
Yeah, you're right. I've been doing Zoom conversations beyond these interviews, staying in touch with other people, trying to address some mental health issues and so on. We're hearing so much, sometimes conflicting information about the COVID-19 virus. It'll be good to hear your thoughts as a genetic scientist. But before we get into that, I'm curious as to what led you to become a genetic scientist? Did you say at 6 years old, I'm going to be a genetic scientist?
I want to study genes. I've always been very interested in science. And in college, I studied biopsychology and the biology of the brain. It's very difficult to study the brain. I'm also was just very interested in fate and sort of what determines our path in life. And it's certainly not all DNA, but DNA does contribute to that to an extent. I don't know. I just, it did also combine my desire to make an impact, short of being a medical doctor, that if I could work on genetic diseases, that I might be able to help families with hereditary diseases. And that's what I did for 25 years at the University of California.
Now, what changed? I hope it's not too personal, but why are you not at the university still?
Right. Good question. Several years ago, I was actually, it's personal, but I'm happy to talk about it.
Okay, good.
In a way, it's an inspiration, I think, to others. 2011, I was diagnosed with ovarian cancer, which is not one of those cancers you really are thrilled to have. Fortunately, I'm 100% fine now. They caught it really early. I went through 2 years of treatment. And at the time, I thought that I wanted to take on a new challenge in life and just try something new. So I had some time to reflect and decided to reinvent myself and try to write a work of fiction. But I certainly incorporated a lot of genetics in hopefully a very fun and engaging way in the book.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that towards the end of our that's definitely something I want to get to. So did you actually decide to take a leap and leave the university, or were you... I had a academic career myself, and I know that academic politics can sometimes get one down.
I think it was more, it wasn't that I had a, that I was, you know, in any way having a bad experience there. It was more that I just wanted to take on a new change. Uh-huh. I did go back for a while and worked part-time, but I found that working part-time at, in a high-intensity science lab is just, it's not terribly effective.
A contradiction in terms, huh?
Yeah, it is. You end up really working full-time plus anyway.
Yeah.
Took away from my writing, so I did step back. I miss it.
I saw that you have a master's degree in something called cytogenics. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Yeah, it's cytogenetics. C-Y-T-O, which yeah, just means
cytogenetics. Cell. Yeah. Right. What the heck is that?
Another good question. Cytogenetics is the study of, essentially the study of chromosomes and how they contribute to disease, such as, so rearrangements on a broad scale of the genome. Oftentimes we see rearrangements of chromosomes in cancers, certainly in blood cancers. And it's one mechanism or means by which we can help diagnose the specific type of cancer. And it's also, of course, used for amniocentesis and prenatal screening.
I could have looked it up, but I wanted to ask you. And it's funny because my mind went, the word cytoplasm somehow is somewhere in my head. Right. And for some reason, what came up was the idea of frozen things. Isn't that root related to freezing people?
Oh, you know, I think you're referring to cryo.
Cryo, that's it.
Right.
That's it. Oh, yeah. I'm cryoing now. Oh boy. Okay. Yeah. You can see my biological ignorance here. Now, similarly, in addition, you have a PhD in molecular genetics. And what's the difference between molecular genetics and the sort of more general way that we talk about genetics?
Right. Well, so there are different divisions of genetics. And one is the cytogenetics, where you're looking at sort of a broader view of chromosomes, okay, whole chromosomes. And then molecular genetics is actually the study of DNA, the DNA molecule, and rearrangements and mutations and, genes that are associated with various diseases. So it's just fine tuning, the analysis of the genome.
Boy, it's amazing how complex reality is at so many levels, but the fact that we can just go down and down and down to where there are all these different specialties, that there's enough complexity at various levels of analysis to create a whole discipline around it.
Yeah. It's always amazing to me too, how well everything actually works when you think of all the possible ways that things could go wrong. Yeah. For the most part, things work pretty well.
Yeah. Yeah. That is good. So the race is on to find a cure for the coronavirus, and I don't know if cure is the right word or not, but from your experience or knowledge, how long is that process for finding cures for viruses? How long does that normally take, and is there any reason to think coronavirus is going to be an especially difficult case?
So I think we need to talk about treatment, basically, versus a cure, which is essentially prevention. So treatment for COVID will occur in, I believe, in a much more rapid timeline than a cure or prevention, which is really what we're talking about is a vaccine. So already in terms of treatment, there are a number of antiviral medications. I don't know if your audience is probably well aware that there are antivirals that are going through clinical trials that were developed for other types of viral diseases.
We've been seeing that on the news.
So there's and some of those basically what they do is interfere with the replication of the viral genome. And I would suspect that and there are two of them. There's remdesivir and something called NHC that it's a very similar kind of compound. And I would imagine that those medications might be available by this summer, we'll hope. And there's also another approach where instead of a vaccination, a recombinant antibody can be created in the pharmaceutical company or in a laboratory, and those antibodies directly injected. So we don't need to wait for the vaccine, in which most often you're introducing like an inactivated or a subunit of a virus and waiting for our immune systems to mount that antibody response. Instead, we can just directly inject the antibodies.
Yeah. Now, what does recombinant mean?
Recombinant means it's basically generated in the laboratory. So you know what the structure and the, you know, the genetic code is that would produce that particular protein or antibody. And so you're able to basically introduce that DNA sequence either into a benign bacteria or yeast and crank out recombinant proteins.
It's interesting to me that yeast has a role to play. I mean, are we talking about yeast like in the yeast that makes bread rise?
Yeah, essentially. Because it in itself doesn't cause disease, and you can grow it in vast quantities in a liquid solution and crank out those antibody proteins and then isolate them and hopefully be able to inject those into individuals either for prevention or treatment.
Yeah, I think that's marvelous that something as ever present with us as yeast is such a good medium for preparing things that are going to go into our body.
Yeah.
It's kind of like yeast and mice are really great, right?
Well, they certainly have been very helpful in terms of screening and production of compounds.
Now, the coronavirus has been compared to SARS and to MERS and similar viral pandemics. Is that a good comparison or not?
Yeah, it's a very accurate comparison. So coronaviruses are actually a class of viruses that both SARS virus, which is called SARS-CoV, this particular virus is called SARS-CoV-2, and the MERS virus, they all belong to this class of coronaviruses that are primarily found in bats. And they are what are called zoonotic. So they have a tendency to jump species from bats to, you know, in the case of SARS, it was to civet cats. And in the case of MERS, it jumped to camels. And then from there into humans. And that seems to be what has happened with this virus too, that it jumped from bats most likely to this creature called a pangolin, which is like a little small spiny anteater. And from there into humans, but it's not, you know, that's the best guess at the moment in terms of how it jumped between species. But they're all basically the same type of virus. They all have a bit of genetic material. In this case, it's RNA, and that is surrounded by this capsid, which we have all seen. It looks like sort of a spiked ball. And so it's the virus that's encapsulated by a lipid layer, fatty layer, and in that layer is a number of these spike proteins. So they all look very similar to one another.
And there's some sort of a lock and key kind of relationship in terms of our vulnerability to the stuff getting into our system?
That's right. So those spike proteins that you see on the outside of the virus, those have a very strong affinity to attach to a receptor that we have on cells that line our lung. So that spike protein will latch onto the receptor of the lung cell, and that's how it enters the cell. So, and that is why this particular virus, it's so very effective at being, it has a very high affinity for that receptor.
Yeah.
But this virus, I mean, so in a way, it's fortunate that we know, and the Chinese did sequence the genome of this virus very early on. So we did know what we were dealing with, what kind of virus it was. It does have a, you know, it's much more transmissible. It's more infectious, but it actually has a much lower mortality rate than the other two, than SARS and MERS.
Why wouldn't animals get this? They have lungs, other mammals, but I haven't heard. It seems like I've heard that no, you don't have to worry about your dog or your cat or
right. Yeah,
you know, getting it from.
So
them.
I guess it could be, you know, pets don't are not affected by this virus. It's not to say that I don't know the answer to this. I don't know if, you know, it could potentially be, you know, if someone in your household does have the virus, that it could be sort of on the surface or hair of your pet. But the cats and dogs do not have this same receptor on their lung cells. Mm-hmm. So the virus does not infect and invade their lungs.
Yeah.
So that's the difference.
I was listening to a podcast just this morning with an animal rights person, and the case was being made that we would not be having these pandemics, that somehow they start with animals, the animals that we treat badly in the factory type conditions that our food animals are raised in.
Mm-hmm.
Does any of that sound fit with anything that you know?
Well, I think, I don't know if it has to do, well, of course, any human interaction affects the animal world as well. In terms of these coronaviruses, they initially, they initiate in bats. I mean, bats harbor coronaviruses, but they have a very strong immune system. So they themselves do not become sick with this virus. So I think environmentally, when their habitat becomes disturbed, there's a much greater likelihood of those bats then interacting with other animals, which in turn interact with humans. I mean, we either eat them, like in the Chinese market, these pangolins are sold as a food source. Mm. I don't know if it's direct mistreatment of a population of animals, but just, overpopulation and destruction of their own habitats.
Yeah. So at some point, the World Health Organization classified the coronavirus as a pandemic.
Right.
And so talk to us about what that means. I was reading a very good article in a recent New Yorker about previous pandemics that have, you know, wiped out large segments of populations, human populations. Yeah.
So an epidemic, there are epidemics and there are pandemics, and they both have to do with a sudden outburst of a disease that affects a large group of people. The only difference between an epidemic and a pandemic is the geographical area that is affected.
Yeah.
So epidemics are more like local kinds of outbreaks and affected populations versus pandemics. When you're looking at what we're seeing now with this virus affecting virtually every continent, you know, populations on every continent.
Yeah. Given that, you know, travel is implicated quite a bit, the barriers have broken down, the natural geographical barriers have broken down. And does that mean that what would have been epidemics are now going to be pandemics and that we're going to see a lot more pandemics?
I don't want to be a doomsayer, but I would say that we are likely to see more pandemics because of, you know, the global nature of our interconnectivity of our world now. The reason that SARS, but I think with improved communication and awareness of the about the onset of these diseases, we can isolate and quarantine populations very early on, and that's why both SARS and MERS sort of died out. And you know, SARS only affected 8,000 people, and you know, unfortunately, 800 of those died, so there was a 10% mortality rate. But MERS only affected 2,500 people, and had a much higher mortality rate. But those numbers are obviously, you know, much less than what we're seeing now.
Yeah. There are people who have been predicting this for some time.
Yes.
Bill Gates, it's been one of the projects on Bill Gates' shopping list of ways to, you know, be helpful in the future.
Yeah.
And there was an interview this morning that I did not get to hear with Larry Brilliant, who, aside from his name, evidently is a very brilliant guy.
Be a shame if he wasn't.
Pardon?
I said it would be a shame if he wasn't.
Yeah, right, right. That would be hard to bear. But evidently, he this is an area that he specialized in for quite some time. Now, a lot of what we're hearing about is flattening the curve.
Mm-hmm.
And something that I learned about a bit ago, you know, at first I thought, oh, flattening the curve, that means, you know, that's like getting rid of it. But somebody pointed out that the area under the curve is the same, whether it's got a high peak or it's flattened. And so the implication, I guess, is either a whole lot of people get it all at the same time and a whole lot of people die, or it's drawn out longer. The same number of people ultimately will get it, and roughly the same number of people will still die. So that the point of flattening it out, if I understand this, is our health systems presumably won't be so overwhelmed.
That's right.
For and so I think, long.
Yeah, you're exactly right. Although part of the purpose of flattening the curve, even though the total area, as you say, remains the same, it is spread out over a longer period of time so that it, you know, there will be many fewer deaths because of that, because our hospital system and medical system will be able to care properly with supportive treatment and not overwhelm the system.
And it might I'm just realizing it might give more time for the development of some kind of treatment that would be effective.
Exactly. That's exactly right. Yeah.
So it buys us time to.
It doesn't overload our medical system, and that will translate into many fewer deaths. It's really critical to flatten that curve.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Wow. That's good to know. That extends my understanding a notch further that I really appreciate.
Yeah.
And what about those people who've survived and are recovering from the coronavirus? How will medical professionals study them, and you know what factors might emerge from that to help us?
Right. Well, I don't know if you've heard, but there is now an antibody test just recently FDA approved, so that we can determine, it's certainly not widely available yet, but we can determine those individuals that have had exposure to the virus, you know, whether they were asymptomatic or came down with symptoms.
Out of China, right? I think I saw in the news some kind of little device. Was that?
Well, I think there's actually one that was developed in the States and also one developed in the UK as well. So, okay. You know, the race is on. It's not really a race, but certainly labs and pharmaceutical companies all over the globe working on this. So there are a number of different antibody tests, but the one that I know of that's approved for use in the United States recently was developed here. So that's important for a lot of reasons, to know whether an individual has been exposed.
Sure.
First of all, scientists and medical professionals will be able to determine, you know, how long that immunity lasts. You know, you can monitor those antibody levels over time and see if the antibodies are, you know, are being constantly made, so that those individuals won't be subject to getting the disease in the future. Secondly, if it's proven that immunity does last, that those individuals can get back to work and help our, you know, the devastation that's occurred economically in the country.
Right.
And then also we'll be able to study those individuals that have had COVID epidemiologically. So they're apparently I've read numbers anywhere from 15 to 30% of individuals are completely asymptomatic. So we will know, you know, the course of this disease and how likely it is for individuals to come down with actual symptoms and disease and what factors contribute to that. I mean, we know that age is a factor, gender is a factor, but there are probably many other genetic factors that we could study populations and determine, you know, which individuals or populations are either more susceptible or more resistant to getting the virus.
Yeah, so there's a lot that we don't know, and that the data isn't there yet, but it's coming in.
This is all new, even though it seems like it's been going on forever.
Right. And we're still kind of early in it. Supposedly in California, we haven't really got the brunt of the wave yet.
I'm hoping, you know, that since we did have a very early on shelter in place mandate, I'm hoping that it's not necessarily true that we're going to have this big surge here.
Yeah, I'm sure hoping not. This is very personal for me, it turns out, because I have a son in his, lost track, but I think he's in his late 30s, I would say, in New York, and he came down with it.
Oh.
And it's been about 14 days. He feels like he's over it, and he's reunited with his wife and 18-month-old daughter just yesterday.
Yeah.
And I'm so glad that he's, quotes, over it, and a little nervous about, well, how do we know that he's really over it? And is there a danger that he might infect them after all?
Yeah, I suppose, you know, there, in addition to the antibody test to determine he will have antibodies at this point, but he could also have, you know, a repeat. I don't know if he was ever tested for the virus itself.
No.
Well, it might not be a bad idea to be tested for the virus to see if he actually still carries the virus.
My sense is that in New York, you can't get tested unless you're an extremist, you know, unless you're in really bad shape.
Oh, yeah, I'm not.
That's what I'm getting from the news is, you know, that is just a like a war zone.
Simply because there just aren't enough tests available.
Right.
Yeah. Well.
Yeah, so the tests are, and even here in California, I can't get tested.
Yeah, not routinely, not unless you have symptoms.
Right, not unless you have symptoms.
I'm hoping, you know, within a few weeks that testing is, you know, much more widely available for purposes such as that.
Yeah.
Even just for peace of mind. You know, likely he doesn't have the virus anymore. He's got antibodies if he's getting over the disease. But
yeah, I hope so. He's if anybody looked like they would have a good chance of getting over it, I mean, very athletic and eats well and had recently become vegan and, you know, and as I say, just works out and looks great. And so,
yeah. Very so he was isolated from the rest of his family?
Yeah, he made the decision as soon as it came on to send you know, he lives with his wife and a little daughter, but he sent them away as soon as he realized that he woke up with it.
And so far they seem to be fine.
Yeah, they seem to be fine.
And this is 14 days later, so that's good news.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's probably okay to be with them at this point.
Yeah. There was another question that popped up and I can't remember what it was now. Are you and your family sheltering in?
Yes, we are. So my husband and I we have three quote unquote kids, but they're all in their 20s and they are up in the Bay Area, all working from home, and everyone so far, knock on wood, is okay. Because those, as I said, you know, that shelter in place was put in, you know, early in the Bay Area.
Yeah.
And I think that that's really helped matters. I think it's probably going to go on for quite a bit longer, but it buys us time.
Yeah.
As you said, it buys us time to flatten the curve and not overwhelm our system. And with any luck, more than luck, but with hopefully there will be some of these antivirals and treatments that are approved and available.
Yeah.
Within a couple months.
So sheltering in seems to involve more and more stuff that you have to be aware of and be doing. What concrete precautions are you taking other than staying in your house in terms of food coming in or getting packages from restaurants or whatever? How are you guys dealing with it?
So I had been going to the market every, say, 4 days, but I'm really reducing that to now just going once a week and wearing gloves and a mask when I do go to the market. When I come home, I dispose of, well, you can wash the cloth masks, but I dispose of the gloves, immediately wash my hands. And that probably is the number one thing we all need to be doing, because soap itself, you know, I was talking about the virus being a RNA molecule that's surrounded by proteins and lipids.
Yeah.
So soap also contains lipids. And what it does is intercalates. It gets into the lipid layer surrounding the virus and basically kills it, breaks it apart. So it's not just general hygiene. It really kills the virus. So what else do I do? You know, you want to support the local restaurants by getting food taken out because, you know, they're suffering as well. There's always a bit of concern with whatever we're doing now, but you just try to keep it to the minimum, you know, and just be aware of if you, you know, start having any of these symptoms to isolate yourself.
I had to go to the dentist this morning and so my wife had me put on a mask and gloves, which I did. And I thought I had lost a crown, but it turns out I lost a tooth, which was very sad news. So I'm going to, at some point, I'm going to want to get a implant.
Right.
But when is that going to be possible? We don't know. I know you can't answer that. And we don't know how long before I'd be able to get a procedure like that done.
It seems to me, of course, I don't know, but it seems to me both from what one hears that by summer we should have some of these medications available to tamp down the disease. And it also may be sort of a seasonal kind of pandemic where in the summertime, you know, many, many fewer people are infected. It doesn't mean that it can't rear up again in the fall or winter. But it might be that, you know, later this summer, you might be able to do that.
Let's hope. My dentist was not feeling terribly optimistic. He was saying that he didn't think his practice would ever go back to normal. That he said first he's going to have to get the special mask and gown and all of that stuff. And he's not sure when he'll be able to get that stuff. It's been in such short supply for first responders. And then he thinks that the days, he thinks he'll only be able to see one person at a time in the office.
That's so many people.
Yeah, that just, you know, sounds like a big change.
Where you've, you know, you've got to be super close and you're exposing the very, you know, avenue by which this virus gets into us.
So you think it probably wouldn't be as bleak as he was painting?
Well, I think his business will suffer in the short term.
Sure.
Yeah.
There's
going to be a lot of people needing dentistry when this is over.
I'm in the process of a different implant. That's only half there. I've got the hardware that they put in your mouth, but it's got to get the dentist then has to put on a crown on it.
Yeah.
So that's been on hold.
Yes. Yeah.
And of course, there are people with much more serious things than that, that are kind of in a holding pattern now, that they, medical conditions that they need to see their doctors about.
That aren't elective. It's you know, some, you know, on top of, many people are just dealing with the usual, you know, difficulties that we
have. Life has a way of throwing challenges our way, and medical challenges. I think this next question probably makes no sense in your case, but are there any of the guidelines that you're ignoring that you're kind of saying, oh, that's not that important, I'm not going to?
No. We're being pretty stringent about it. Yeah. I'm only a bit concerned about my mother, is 90, almost 92, and she lives in Maryland. She does live in a retirement community. So, and I know that they're being extremely cautious there, but in my mind, I am just wondering what I would do if she does get sick. You know, somebody's got to care for her. And I would probably then take the risk of flying there and caring for her, even though none of us want to go to an airport or get into an airplane at this point. But, you know, sometimes I just couldn't stand the fact of her, you know, going through this on her own.
Yeah, Yeah.
I mean, if she's in a hospital or a facility, I wouldn't be able to. But if she's still in her own individual, you know, unit, uh-huh. we can both just sequester there. But well, short of that no, I think yeah. we're being very, very cautious here.
Yeah. Yeah. One of the question that had slipped my mind was this: from a certain scientific point of view, this could be seen as an exciting time, maybe. And so is there any part of you that would be tempted to go back into a lab somewhere to be on the frontier of this science that's going on right now?
Yeah, it is intellectually and scientifically very, you know, stimulating to try to, you know, determine, you know, first of all, what this virus is, what is the likelihood of the virus mutating, and being able to use genetics to determine some of those things. It would certainly be exciting. Time to be in that area. You know, it's really important for scientists to determine how rapidly this particular virus mutates, because any vaccines that we develop, you know, we'll be able to combat the virus as it stands today. But if it mutates, like many of the influenza viruses do, and that's why we need to get a new flu shot every year, because they're different strains of flu. Mm-hmm. So we have to really stay on top of the genetics of this. This thing.
I've heard that discussed on the news, and it seems like I've gotten mixed messages of, it's not going to mutate that quickly. You got to be worried about mutation.
Well, I think in general, we do have to be worried about mutations of viruses, because that's how they evade the immune system. You know, if they're antibodies that can combat one form of this virus, if the virus is able to mutate to an extent where it can avoid interaction with that antibody, then it can continue its life cycle of replication. But it does seem... one small bit of good news, that this virus is not mutating very rapidly by any means.
Maybe that's the confusion that I heard. Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah. But it's something that's we're going to have to keep an eye on.
Well, as a molecular geneticist, you said that you kind of specialize in DNA. And is there any way that DNA can be useful in this fight against the virus, and how so?
Yeah, well, I think it already has been very useful. I mean, as I mentioned earlier, the Chinese very early on in January were able to sequence the genome of this virus, so we knew precisely what we were dealing with. So that's one bit of use of DNA technology, so that we know what we're dealing with here. Secondly, the test for the virus itself is a DNA-based test. So it uses what's called PCR, which is an amplification of the RNA and DNA, so that it's a very standard test in laboratories. So that's another bit of DNA technology that's been useful. And it also can help us jumpstart the vaccine development, because if you know what the DNA, in this case it is RNA, codes for what particular proteins this virus would make, then we can model antibodies that could basically attack those specific proteins. So I think, you know, we're ahead of the game, head of the curve here, in because we do have some very sophisticated DNA technologies that were put to use right away.
Well, I get the impression that you are reasonably optimistic that we're going to get through this and that it's not going to wipe out the planet.
That's right. It's hard. It's hard to sort of think that way, but this won't go on forever. Yeah. Particularly if people, you know, viruses cannot live on their own. They need hosts. They need, in this case, they need humans to be infected for in order for them to replicate. And once we develop a vaccine or antibody or treatment, you know, and if people still do adhere to social distancing, this will diminish over time. It doesn't seem like that right now, especially since we're talking about vaccines not being available until, you know, the earliest I've heard is January of next year. So this will go on for a while. Mm-hmm. But also the more people that are infected, and develop immunity, then there's something called herd immunity. I don't know if you've heard about that, but the more people that are immune to this virus, the virus then has fewer people or hosts to infect. So the transmission becomes less and less. So, you know, over time, this will subside, but not for a while.
We just got to hang on.
Yes.
Hang on. Now, as a DNA specialist, well, you've mentioned that you left your academic position to become a writer.
Right.
And evidently, you've got a book that DNA is part of the story, not too surprisingly. you've written, I don't know if it's out quite yet, it's called Double Blind, The Icelandic Manuscript Murders. Now, I'm a big fan of a Nordic noir.
So, it all started.
Tell us about your book. Is it out yet?
So it just came out last Tuesday.
Wow.
So March 31st. It is out. It's available, well, obviously not in bookstores, which aren't open right now, but online, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Better World Books. And so it's available online.
But so have you been to Iceland? How did you end up setting your mystery in Iceland?
Good question. So I knew that I love Nordic noir as well. So I love those Scandinavian countries.
Yeah.
I knew that Iceland has a national DNA database. It's actually a company that has collected voluntarily DNA on the majority of its citizens. And they're using that DNA database to determine what genes and what mutations predispose individuals to common diseases like Alzheimer's or heart disease or cancer. So it has a very noble purpose. So I went to Iceland to take a tour of that company. And when I was there, I just fell in love with the country and its people and the culture. And
wow.
I don't know if you've been there, but it's
I have
the
not.
Yeah, you gotta go.
I've been to Sweden for a couple of weeks.
Oh yeah,
that's my only Nordic.
I haven't been to, but I've been to Iceland now, I think 7 times.
Oh,
spent
boy.
A lot of time there. So when I was there too, I learned that they have a body of medieval literature called the Icelandic sagas that are based on the original settlers 1,000 years ago of Iceland. And they're medieval manuscripts that were written in the 13th century, 12th and 13th centuries, and they still exist to this day. So I was able to go down into the vault of the Manuscript Institute and put these like white gloves and leaf through this old vellum manuscript. And I thought, okay, between the landscape and the remote farmsteads and this medieval literature and the DNA database, there's got to be a good story here or a mystery. So that's, it all sort of came together because of all of those factors.
Wow. Wow. How did you find writing it? Was it difficult, taxing, nerve-wracking? Or just flew out of here?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes, the above.
That's what it would be for me. I find the Icelandic stuff that I've been exposed to, like on Netflix and some of the there were some good channels that you could get that had a lot of that stuff. And it seemed like the Icelandic was more dark and more violent than the stuff coming out of Sweden and Norway.
In terms of the series and the show,
the violence in it.
Which is really interesting because in reality, it has one of the absolute lowest crime rates in the entire world. But I think it's because of the moodiness of the place. You know, it's dark half of the year. You know, there's a lot of remote locations and it's very eerie landscapes and people can be quite isolated from one another. So just in terms of the imagination, if you let that run a little bit wild, it seems like a place that could be violent, but it's really not at all.
Is there any violence in your book?
Well, there are some deaths. Can't give away too much.
Okay.
But they're not violent. Well, they were intentionally caused. By a serial killer. I understand you wrote a book on serial killers.
Well, that's true. I didn't know. I don't know how you figured that out, but I did.
And it was on the Zodiac.
Yes. The Zodiac serial killer. And, you know, I would think that I did that some time back, and I'm sort of my interests have moved on, right? But I'm still contacted by people. And
because it's a fascinating topic to get into.
People are fascinated with it. There are people they're sort of serial killer hobbyists, if you will. Because they can't get enough information about this stuff. Well, I had a production company interview me. I guess it was earlier in 2019. I don't remember exactly when. And they made a really good series of 4 episodes that are on Hulu and on the FX channel.
Okay.
And it's called The Most Dangerous Animal of All.
Okay.
And it's not as gruesome. I mean, the facts of people getting murdered is gruesome, but it's not like the videos don't focus on that, concentrate on that so much. And the story is fascinating because it goes beyond the Zodiac to this, and I don't want to spoil it too much, but about a guy who believes that the Zodiac was his father and all the weird complications that flow from that. And it is an excellent series from that point of view.
Great. Well, we all have time to watch it now, so I'm going to start that tonight.
Let me know what you think. I mean, and the great thing about it for me is this was the second time that I got interviewed by a film company that wanted to create something for TV. And the first time, I ended up on the cutting room floor. There was none of the interview, you know, hours and hours, nothing of me in there. That was a disappointment.
Yes,
I'm sure. The second one, it's got 4 episodes, and I'm in each of the 4 episodes.
That's fantastic. Tell me the name of it again.
The Most Dangerous Animal of All.
Okay.
And I'm sure they're going to keep running it. It's you know, it had its debut on a certain date, but I'm sure it's still on FX, and it's definitely on Hulu.
Great. Thanks.
The other good thing about it for me is I look reasonable and wise. The way they constructed it and the piece, I mean, I don't know how much experience you've had with the media, but they can shape it however they want to shape it. Can come out looking really bad. And so I was just relieved to...
That's fantastic.
...feel good about it. Yeah. I felt good about the way I was represented.
That brings to mind early on in my career, our lab was one of the labs, or the lab, that isolated the gene that's associated with dwarfism. It's called achondroplasia. And we were all quite proud that we had been able to identify the mutation, and this is what's, you know, causing the condition. So there was a 60 Minutes, I think it was Leslie Stahl that came to interview the head of my lab. And they twisted it into something horrible, because it's like, are you trying to eliminate dwarfism now that you know what causes a disease? And, you know, so sometimes you just get kind of blindsided.
It's easy to trip over these, like bomb cords, whatever you would call it, trip wires. You know, like that's happened to people around deafness, you know, and people who, there's a whole community there, and they're doing just fine. Thank you. Don't be messing with our community.
Right. And understandably.
So, well, it's been delightful speaking with you.
Likewise.
Maybe again, under better circumstances.
Yeah. We'll pick it up again this summer, maybe.
Hey, there's an idea.
Good luck to your son. And his family.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So, Sarah Winokur, I want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you. It's been a real pleasure.
I was eager for the opportunity to speak one-on-one with a knowledgeable scientist about the current COVID-19 crisis. Dr. Sarah Winokur certainly fits the bill with her advanced degrees in both cytogenetics and molecular genetics. Every day we're being inundated with news stories related to the COVID-19 crisis. Much of it seems repetitive, and of course we always have to realize where it's coming from. Where the news is coming from, that is. What corporate or political master is being served? Is there a possible hidden agenda? Since Dr. Winokur is currently a freelancer, we can trust her opinions to be based on the science alone, unbiased by hidden agendas. Two things stand out for me in this interview. First, we've all been told with increasing urgency that we all need to cooperate in, quotes, flattening the curve by staying indoors and practicing social distancing. I had learned from the reporting of another scientist whom I trust, Dr. David A. Sinclair, author of Lifespan, that actually the area under the curve is the same, whether steep or flattened. This suggested to me, either way, the same numbers of people would ultimately become sick with the virus, and the same number would die. That's sort of true as an abstraction, but what I learned from Dr. Winokur is that flattening the curve slows down the spread of the virus, giving scientists more time to come up with a treatment or create a vaccine. It buys us more time for the science and also spreads out the load on our already overloaded medical systems. Secondly, I learned that Dr. Winokur, who knows the science, is taking all of this very seriously in her own personal life, sheltering in, minimizing trips outside to the bare minimum, disinfecting everything in her environment that she can, and practicing social distancing. If she's taking it this seriously, so should the rest of us. I guess there's a third takeaway from the interview. I'm heartened to learn that as seriously as Dr. Winokur is taking this threat, she definitely views it as time-limited and not wiping out all of humanity. She points out that we've had serious encounters with viruses in the past and have always managed to prevail. So right now, I'm hanging on to that.
Hello, Dr. Dave. This is Morgan Adolfsen from Norway, clinical psychologist. I've been a long-time listener to both Wise Counsel and Shrink Wrap Radio. Today, I'm so happy that I pressed the donate button. So from this day, I will regularly contribute to support your shows, and I really appreciate your work, Dave. So good luck. Thank you.
Thank you, Morgan Adolfsson, clinical psychologist in Norway. I really appreciate your continuing support for the work I'm doing here. And I want to say thank you to all our other ongoing financial donors. You know who you are. And I do too. Another way listeners can support the show is to transcribe a favorite episode. We have a new transcript for number 649, Working with Attachment and Trauma with Daniel Brown, PhD, and has been updated and prettified by our friends at the Science of Psychotherapy. They do a terrific job of formatting it in an online magazine-type format. Thanks also to longtime Iranian listener Mayar Alanagi for transcribing number 676, More Reflections from UK Psychoanalyst and Author Professor Brett Carr. I highly recommend that one as well. Brett Carr is such a great guest. We also have a new transcript for episode number 672, Philosophical Counseling with philosopher Daniel Finke, PhD, and thanks for that to longtime listener Ellie Knobs. Previously, I shared here that my son Matthew in New York City had come down with the virus. He seems to have gotten over it without any hospitalization and is reunited with his wife and daughter. We are extremely grateful. With that, I think we'll wrap it up for today. Thanks to today's guest, geneticist Sarah Winokur, for sharing her perspective as a scientist on the current pandemic. My next guest will be Dr. Robert Mueller, author of Trauma and the Struggle to Open Up. This conversation should be especially relevant at this point in time. So this is Dr. Dave saying, let's all shelter in during this time of crisis and do what we can to support one another.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.